All right. Good morning. I'd like to speak about things that go perhaps beyond genome-wide selection or genomic selection. This work is done at the University of Minnesota. I acknowledge my co-author, a part-time postdoc, Dr. Sushan Roo. To set the context, I'd like to think of a breeding triangle. We're familiar with a disease triangle. This is a breeding triangle where the middle is good cultivars, and we need three things for that to happen. We need good germplasm, we need good breeders, and we need good tools and resources. If you take out any of these three, we will not have good cultivars in the end. And so what I'd like to focus first is this part on having good tools and resources, and one of those tools and resources would be genomic selection or genome-wide selection. The basic model is P equals G plus E. The phenotypic value is equal to a genotypic value, which we cannot directly estimate, we infer, plus some noise or some non-genetic or non-genetic value or environmental value. And what we basically do, as Zheng Lu showed earlier, is that we still have the equation P and E, but we use the sum of marker effects carried by an individual as a surrogate or as a substitute for that genotypic value. Meaning that instead of doing our phenotyping all the time, we could analyze a line or a candidate for molecular markers, and we use those marker effects, we sum them up, and that is our substitute or our surrogate for your genotypic value. My former students and I have investigated genome-wide selection in maize breeding, which maize breeding these days pretty much looks like this. You cross inbred A with inbred B. You develop doubled haploids either from F1 plants or from F2 plants if you want to do some selection among F2 plants or increase recombination. Because it is a hybrid species, evaluation is not based mostly on the performance of the lines themselves, but the performance of the line in hybrid combination when crossed to a tester called inbred T. And again, if there are good lines, they could be released as new inbreds based on yield performance in test cross combination, but also in disease resistance and other traits for the lines themselves. Genome-wide selection will be most effective if it can be applied to those phases of the breeding program when phenotypic selection is least effective. In fact, if phenotypic selection has zero effectiveness, then there is much room for improvement by the use of markers. And a place in the breeding program where that happens in maize is selection either among doubled haploids or among F2 plants for yield. For example, selection for hybrid yield of F2 plants has practically zero effectiveness, one, because heritability on an individual plant basis is near zero. Second, the yield of an F2 plant, if it has a big ear, will not predict the yield of a haploid, doubled haploid, derived from that line in hybrid combination. And so again, that is a place where we believe the procedure has most value, and that is what we have then investigated. And what we have arrived at is, instead of having a system where you have one predictive equation for everything, we figured it's better if we try to maximize the predictive ability within each cross. And so the system that we have found that works well is that if I have my test population crosses A by B with progeny A by B, a suitable training population is if you as a breeder would go back to all prior populations with A as one parent, and all prior populations with B as one parent, you pool all those together as your training population for this A by B cross. If you have another cross, C by D, you do the same. Look for all prior crosses with C as a parent, D as a parent, pool those together. That is your training population for C by D. And we found that if you do this procedure, you would expect about 84 to 88% of the gains that you would eventually get from phenotypic selection at about 20 to 25% of the cost. So there's a cost effectiveness to it. There's a time effectiveness to it because you don't need to wait for the field data. And again, what we've found, and this is from a large data set from the Monsanto company, which I wish to acknowledge, is that again, you gain about 85% of what you would eventually gain from phenotypic selection when in fact that phenotypic selection is not possible among F2 plants. And so, if I were to summarize now, then the status of genome-wide selection, at least in maize, I would say it is routine, it is no longer new, and the current status is keep going. And I've heard firsthand that actually, again, genome-wide selection is now routinely used in maize, that products coming to the market today have had some flavor, if you would, or tasted genome-wide predictions at some point during the development of those products. And it turns out, again, that if you look, there are many procedures that have been developed to estimate genome-wide marker effects. The most common ones are ridge regression BLOP, RRBLOP, which has been found equivalent to what is called as GBLOP. In GBLOP, basically, the relatedness among the candidates is assessed not from pedigree, but based on molecular markers. It turns out that GBLOP is not new. I did some hybrid prediction work back in the 1990s when I was with Limagrain, and actually I was doing GBLOP by 1994. Didn't make too big a deal out of it, but it's interesting how that procedure has now become routine and well used both in the plant breeding literature as well as in the animal breeding literature. Where this brings us, though, is what comes next? If it is routine, what are some things that might come after genome-wide selection? And so I'm beginning to look more at that top part of that breeding triangle, to look more into the germplasm piece, because I believe that the time is coming, or has now come, at least in maize, in which the different breeding organizations will be pretty much using the same breeding approaches, will be using the same tools. They'll be using markers, using doubled haploids, using double plot combines, using year-round winter nurseries, pretty much in a way doing the same thing. But what would differentiate one organization from the other would be the base germplasm that they have, that they would have, but their competitors would not have. So I've been beginning to think of the question, how can we use genome-wide markers now to begin to better understand the germplasm base that we have and to improve the germplasm base that we have. One thought is to think of what we might call as chromosome-wide marker effects. We could think of each chromosome as a package of genes that is passed intact, oftentimes, from parent to offspring. Not always intact, but oftentimes passed intact, particularly with doubled haploids. With doubled haploids, there are limited recombinations in the development of a homozygous line, and so it is quite common that an entire chromosome would be passed intact from parent to offspring, but you have a shuffling of those chromosomes from the two parents. And so let us say that we have line one, we have eight markers on a chromosome. This is one chromosome. And you see with biallelic SNP markers that if the effect of one is -2, the effect of the other allele will be the minus of that one. So it's a pretty simple system. And so what we can do then is just sum the effects of the marker alleles carried by a line on a given chromosome, and that is the value of that line for that chromosome for that particular trait. So in this case, line 1 has a value of 0.2, and line 2 has a higher value, 2.0, and you see more blues than reds over there. And so if you do that on a large scale, you could do that for a large number of lines, you could do that for several traits, and you could do that for all chromosomes, and you'd get a heat map such as this one. So this is a heat map of the chromosome-wide marker effects for about 270 lines that are indicated. Each row is a line. And then we have different traits, anthesis date, plant height, starch concentration, protein concentration, northern corn leaf blight. And on the top are the subpopulation assignments to which the lines below belong. And you could look at this and begin to get ideas of how the favorable alleles are organized or are arranged in the germplasm collection that you have. And you could see, for example, you could begin to get insights. For example, let us assume that you want lower protein. Lower protein means higher yield in corn, and protein in corn is in good quality anyway for the most part. So let's say you want lower protein to increase yield, and lower protein is in blue. And so if you look at these B73 lines over here, you would see that B73 lines are pretty deficient for protein on chromosome number 10. And so if you have something like this, you could begin to envision a simple chromosome substitution approach. If I introduce or introgress a whole chromosome from a source into a B73 line, would that improve protein? Of course, that would change other traits as well, but that's another story. Now, as I look at a heat map like this, this brought me back to a seminar I gave 15 years ago or so in Madison, in which I was thinking about how a plant breeder differs in the way that he or she breeds plants to a car engineer, because I had a car engineer at Purdue, friend at Purdue at that time. A car engineer would take all the knowledge that he or she has and put it into a design process and assemble metal and rubber and computers and so forth and come up with a better car. However, if a breeder were to develop design cars the way he or she breeds plants, this is what would happen. The breeder would take two high-performance cars, a Ferrari and a Lamborghini, shuffle those parts together to come up with something new, select the best shuffled car, and repeat that same process. Now, why is that? Well, we do have control about several aspects, parental selection and the process, but we have no control over meiosis. We have no control over fertilization. We have been at the mercy, if you would, of random chance during this process of the shuffling of alleles during normal meiosis. Now, I think, though, that the tools might be there so that we might not always have to do this random shuffling anymore. I'll say that again because you did not mishear me. We now have the tools, I believe, that we don't have to do that. So we can begin to think of what we might call as targeted recombination. Targeted recombination is the ability to have a recombination precisely where a plant breeder would like that recombination to be. So for example, let us say we have line 2 with, again, this is the same chromosome, and these are the values of the marker alleles carried by this line 2. A breeder can begin to ask, where should recombination be? Again, these are marker effects from genome-wide predictions. We're taking the marker effects from genome-wide predictions and asking it to do somewhere else to ask the question, where should recombination be? And you can walk through the chromosome. It doesn't take too long to determine that if there is a recombination in this example between markers 2 and 3, and you recover the good homologue, not the bad one, but the good one, you could get a doubled haploid in this case with a value of 2.2 instead of the values that are near zero to what you started with. So again, we're using genome-wide marker effects to begin to target where recombination should be. That's the first part. The second part is, well, do we actually have those tools to do targeted recombination? And the answer could be yes. CRISPR, we've all heard of CRISPR for genome editing, but it has been shown that CRISPR, at least in yeast, has been used also for targeted recombination. The idea is CRISPR technology makes a double-stranded break in the DNA, which then triggers a natural repair mechanism of homologous recombination. So what they've done in yeast is that they have used CRISPR technology to make specific breaks on in the yeast genome to map a trait for manganese magnesium sensitivity. And with this technology, they were able to map it to a single variant on chromosome number 7. And so the idea is, well, we have this tool that can do targeted recombination not during meiosis, but during mitosis. Can this procedure eventually be used in higher plants to achieve targeted recombination? And so if you look at this flow chart, the basic tools are there, But you need to add in higher plants. You need to recover the homologue with the targeted recombination. You actually need to isolate those cells in a transformation system. You need to regenerate them into whole plants. Then you need to make doubled haploids. Now, this is a pretty involved process, and before embarking on this one, you would like to know, is it worth it? If it would increase gain by 10% compared to current procedures, it might not be worth it, because that's a lot of work for 10% more gain. But if it increases gain by a larger amount, say 50% or more, then perhaps it might be worth embarking on developing a protocol for targeted recombination in higher plants. So what I tried to do was to ask the question, if we can have targeted recombination, how much gain do we get? And so I looked into two previous experiments we've conducted at the University of Minnesota. The one that I'll talk about today is the classic B73 by Missouri 17 population. It had 180 lines that we test crossed to a commercial tester, and we used a map from Iowa State University of 892 SNP markers. And this is what we found. Focusing on grain yield, the mean grain yield in the population was 8982 kilograms per hectare, or 8.98 metric tons per hectare. If the breeder were to select the best out of the 180 lines, the mean yield was 9618. 9618 over 8982, that's a 7% gain. We gain 7% in yield if we select the best line that occurred from natural recombination. Now, if we can have targeted recombination, one recombination event on each of the 10 chromosomes, the predicted yield of the resulting line, again, one targeted recombination on each of the 10 chromosomes, is 10,330. 10,330 over 8982 is 15%. And so 15% gain with targeted recombination versus about 7% gain with natural, non-targeted recombination, that's a relative efficiency of 212. In other words, if we can have targeted recombination, we can possibly double the genetic gains for grain yield in this population. If we can have two targeted recombination events, then the gains further increase to about 254. And for the other traits, sick trends, we basically can double genetic gains if we can have targeted recombination in maize. If we look at the profile of the gains across the genome, so this is the gains that we would expect for yield, moisture, and yield index if recombination were to occur along the different positions in the genome. We have the blue first one here is chromosome 1, orange chromosome 2, blue chromosome 3, and then chromosome 4, and so on. We see a few things. One is, again, the gains from targeted recombination differ across the chromosome. By the way, the green triangle indicates where the targeted recombination should be. Targeted recombination was highest on chromosome 1. It was also high on chromosomes 3 and 5. It was lowest on chromosome 4, meaning that not all chromosomes have an equal contribution to yield. Second point we see is that the positions of the targeted recombination differ from trait to trait. There was no correspondence between the positions of targeted recombination for yield and moisture. What that means in practice is right now breeders typically do not have a selection index prior to selection. Instead, you get the progeny and you determine which to select based on the perceived importance of the trait. If you are to do targeted recombination, you need to specify that index in advance, because how you weight different traits would affect where those targeted recombination points would be. We have since extended this work to different populations in self-pollinated species, soybean, wheat, barley, and pea, and we found that basically, yes, we still get the same magnitude of gains, about doubling the rate of genetic gain if we can have one targeted recombination per chromosome. Some considerations, well, the predictions ought to be effective. If your genome-wide predictions are not accurate enough, then you're basing your targeted recombination on noise. Second, you might need to prioritize chromosomes, especially for species with large numbers of chromosomes. If not all chromosomes are equal, then you prioritize some. Third, the targeted recombination here identifies only those places in the genome where targeted recombination, where natural recombination already takes place. You're estimating genome-wide marker effects which depend on the natural recombination during meiosis. However, perhaps CRISPR can be used for targeted recombination in those cold spots or regions in the genome where there's not much recombination going on, but it would allow breeders to see what we might call as the far side of the moon or the dark side of the moon. We don't know what's there because we actually have not seen it. And I think that would be a fascinating application of CRISPR technology, again, not just for genome editing, but for recombination to see what might be hidden in those cold spots. Another application I thought about was actually introgression of exotic germplasm. Right now, exotic germplasm introgression has often relied on finding marker QTL associations and then introgressing QTL from an exotic source to a donor source. A possible approach would be actually not to introgress just one QTL, but to introgress a segment from that donor source, and you then identify the segment that you need to introgress based on the sum of genome-wide marker effects in that particular segment. So that is something that we're beginning to investigate now in my program at Minnesota. Also, I'm beginning to think that perhaps we won't need CRISPR after all. That we could, just by selecting for the natural recombinations that occur among the progeny, actually come up with this at the same point as we would for CRISPR. What I'm saying is, if you have 200 lines, chances are among those 200 lines, one of those carry the targeted recombination on chromosome 1. One carries a targeted recombination on chromosome 2, and so forth. So the first step would be to develop a library of lines that has targeted recombination in each of the chromosomes. The second step would be to pyramid those in one line. So it'll be like marker-assisted backcrossing, if you would, except you're backcrossing not transgenic events, but you're backcrossing recombinants, and you're doing it for as many chromosomes as you want. We see that can happen because there are two steps. One, you want in the first step, you actually want recombination, and in maize, yes, there's recombination in each chromosome. The second step, when you're pyramiding, you actually do not want recombination, because you don't want to undo what you've already done. For that, you do not want recombination, and yes, in maize, there's a good frequency of chromosomes that are passed intact from parent to offspring in doubled haploids. So, again, looking beyond genome-wide selection, what I'm proposing is that we use genome-wide marker effects to study germplasm architecture. We'll also use marker effects to see where those recombination points should be. We could potentially double the rates of yield gains for a quantitative trait such as yield. And again, this is an entirely new paradigm because it's more of a design approach, if you would, for a quantitative trait that we've had. This previous point is a big deal, so I need to mention it again because it's not every day that I say, yes, you could potentially double the rates of gain. And again, I think we can have targeted recombination without the use of CRISPR, after all. Unless you're in sugarcane with 130 chromosomes, then you need to forget about that. So thank you very much for having me. Yes.
So what if there is a strong F-static effect, so that 1+1 is much smaller than 2?
Yeah, that's a good question. So what I'm proposing to do is we answer that question by actually doing it and see what we get. By the way, I forgot to announce I'm hiring a postdoc on this project. So if you're looking for a postdoc, or if you have a student who you think would be a good postdoc for this project to actually try it out, please let me know. Gary.
Maybe a more general question for the two of you. a lot of your work has been around the, you know, prediction of performance as opposed to prediction of breeding value. You've done a fair bit on breeding value. Right now, plant breeders don't separate those processes. We need, I mean, it seems to me we need to. We should be selecting lines for recombination at the, you know, out of those double haploid populations in the same way that the animal breeders are selecting for use as parents, you know, bulls that haven't been phenotypically evaluated. Are you seeing that happening? Do you know if that's happening in the
process? Yeah, so 2 points. One is, if there is a distinction, my intuition is by the time you look at several traits, for practical purposes, that distinction will disappear. I mean, if you look at several traits at the same time, in the end, yeah, you're choosing the best parent for multiple traits, which would tend to be, I think, you know, the ones that would give you the best hybrid performance as well. Second is, I think, in plants, and this is my opinion, and you're free to disagree, in plants, it's a misnomer to use GEBVs. The reason is GEBVs can be used in dairy cattle where the performance is the actual performance of the progeny. In plants, we make evaluations not on the performance of the progeny, but it's on the performance of the line by itself in a yield trial. So there's
predict,
a difference
if
there.
If you want to predict the line, but if you want to select the parent for the next cycle.
Well, and if that's the case, yeah. then we need to collect not the data on the parent performance by itself, but we need to be analyzing the performance of the progeny. And we don't do that. Now, under an additive model, those are highly correlated, but again, the question is, well, is it really an additive model or not?
Why don't we do that? I mean, there's still white and everything. I mean, in the dairy stuff, they've shown a tremendous advantage at an extremely low cost. Should we rethink how we do the plan?
I think in dairy cattle, it's a function because you sell semen. But in plants,
right.
You to a farmer, you're selling not based on the performance of the progeny, but the performance of the actual product.
Yeah. Milk yield is steadily going up, and they have, and because of that, as you know, they're using different algorithms for the SNP markers to do predictions based upon that too. And you know, where we sort of went stagnant, they've now skyrocketed up in terms of milk yield in the last couple of years.
Well, it can be done. It's just a matter. It's a matter of, you know, again, evaluate if it's truly breeding value, then you're not analyzing the performance of that line by itself. You're analyzing the performance of its progeny.
Or its relatives.
Or its relatives. Yeah.
And that's what you can reduce the cost.
Yeah. Yeah.
I see this is very promising in the areas of speed breeding, breaking of linkages, side linkages, and also the question of genetic drive, assuming that you have additive. Could you verify some of those technologies using two traits that are tied to the length and then see if you can break those? And that would be a very good verification of critical tools.
Yeah. Well, yeah, if it's due to linkage, yes. If it's due to pleiotropy, then no. Yeah. But no, if there's a known case where you have an unfavorable relationship between two traits purely because of linkage, then yes. So yes, in fact, I think it's great to be thinking about this because we've thought of CRISPR mainly for genome editing, but I think CRISPR has large applications for breaking linkages, even for, say, even in transgenics, making a cleaner back cross. I mean, there's possible applications there as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, yes. I mean, there certainly are. It's nice to hear these ideas of possible validation. It's one thing to propose something and talk about it here, but we'll see in a few years.
Any other questions? I have one comment.
Yes, sir.
In your approach, then you can use a sort of two-stage or two-step selection index because you will put a weight on the chromosome and then a weight on the trait.
Yes, that's one way. Except. The thing though is I don't know if you can separate those because the chromosomes affect different traits, right? And so that's something to think about whether a two-stage process would be the best. Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.